Welcome to My Property World, a light and informative look at all things property. We have designed this series for people involved in property and property finance in the UK market. However, we do take examples from all around the property world. Our aim is for us to make money from property together. Whether that be buying, selling, financing, trading, or getting involved in a deal in another way. We do this by informing, entertaining, and enjoying ourselves talking property, which gives you a chance to get to know us, what we're up to, and to check us out until you're ready to make money together. In the meantime, My Property World is free and fun, so plug in your headphones and enjoy. We would love for you to like, share, and comment, so please do on social media. And if you have questions, ideas for topics, or deals you would like to explore, we're always looking for guests, so get in touch via the My Property World profile.
Cool. Hello, and welcome to another episode of My Property World. Once again, we're joined by Ben Nichols from Bristol. We're going to be talking HMOs, and the Bristol property market. You're very welcome back on, Ben. And Ben, could you, before you even say hello, I'd like you to state your letting agency website based in Bristol. What is it?
So our agency is KPA Property Management, which is www.kpa.co.uk.
Okay, so that's kpa.co.uk. Right. Okay, well, you're very welcome, Ben.
Thank you very much for having me back, Will. I'm looking forward to getting to a topic that I'm quite passionate about, which is shared houses and the Bristol market.
Okay, so that concept of shared housing, we're going to be covering your experiences, how the market's changing. We're going to talk about the importance of good agents, how you're seeking to disrupt and have disrupted your local market, and how shared housing is approached, and some of the reasons behind that. We're going to get into some of the meaty challenges and talk about some of the commercialities, including asset management, and is it actually a good thing to stay in HMO? So let's start with the Bristol property market. So for listeners who are a bit further afield, they haven't had the joy to have been to Bristol, paint us a picture of what Bristol is as a city and a little overview of the property market there.
Yeah, of course. Well, that's one of the things that's fantastic about the city. It is infectious. So any of your listeners that haven't been to Bristol, come down, come check us out, and you'll probably be moving down here soon, because it's a wonderful, wonderful city. The powerful thing about Bristol is it's many cities within one, and that's one of the things that I love about it. So what do I mean by that? Well, there's different cultures across the city, different people in different places from a myriad of backgrounds, and everybody intermingles with each other and gets on. Often where London can be pockets of different cultures, Bristol is everybody living together, working together, and getting along with each other. So when we talk about HMOs and shared houses, what do we mean by that? Well, there is a different types of properties and different types of shared houses. Everything from three friends living together through to student properties up to your massive mega mos that you see with 40 or 50 bedrooms. A lot of investors don't realize that an HMO can be as small as three people. They think about shared houses, they think of groups of five, six, and often more. But three or more people from two or more households is the legal definition of an HMO. Licensing can confuse that at times because people think, well, if it's not licensed, surely it's not an HMO, but it still is. So if we're looking at Bristol as a city, we've got this two universities, one in the centre, which is the University of Bristol, and then one in the north of the city, which is UWE, the University of West England. And of course, around those, you see pockets of student houses. You get a lot of student HMOs, especially second years and third years, people that maybe in their first year, they lived in halls of residence, they've met their friends either on their course or people they live within a flat. They've banded together as a group, and then they've gone out and taken on a share.
And as a percentage of the Bristol metropolitan area, what would be the student population, either in absolute numbers or a percentage?
So it's a lot denser as you get to the universities. I'd say overall it's about 15% or so. But when you start to come closer to the universities, they become a lot more clustered just because of the location. Students want, they want to roll out of bed as late as possible when they want to go into university.
Walk across the road to a lecture.
Exactly that. Or they want to be right next to a nightclub, so it's not a long taxi or walk home. So they very much pick the properties based upon where they can be from that perspective. And that actually brings quite nicely on to Article 4, which I will talk about more as a challenge later on. But the city is very much trying to control the saturation of those student properties and also of HMOs in general. So as well as the universities, obviously we've got UWE in the north and Bristol in the centre. We also see that with Bristol, there's a lot of shared houses dotted around. And it tends to be the closer to the city centre, the more shared houses that there are, because people are happy to live in a close walking distance to where they work, all the amenities that they want, restaurants, cafes, bars, things on their doorstep that as a household they can go and do. So they choose a shared house in order to do that. So Bristol, south, we've got Southfield, Bedminster. It's kind of up and coming, very bohemian. A lot of working professionals there. We've got some shared houses in the south that are very well looked after. If you kind of work your way around across the bottom towards Temple Meads, you've got a lot more business there, a lot more financial services, that sort of thing. Coming back to the city centre, you've got a melting pot. There's absolutely everything there and various different types of people. If you then go over to Clifton, that's a slightly posher area, I would say, is probably the nice way of putting it. Lots of old Victorian, Edwardian properties, big high ceilings, lovely bay windows, some fantastic property down there. It's lovely. It really, really is. And then as we go closer towards the north of the city, you've got much more of an engineering hub. So you've got an Airbus up there, Rolls-Royce, the MOD, which is actually the second biggest employer in Bristol, and lots of bits and pieces like that.
And just at a high level, if a landlord or property owner had a, we'll say a 4 or 5 bed property, what would they rent that as a family let, standard buy to let on a AST or short assured tenancy?
Sure. So we've seen that recently that has blown, you know, the market has blown up and those rents are going up. But if we're talking kind of average across the city centre, across the city, we're looking at about 1400. And that's for your very simple standard family house, you know, 3-bed semi with the single over the front above the stairs, you know, classic property that you would expect to see. If you were to then convert to an HMO, either by doing an extension out the back, so then you get an extra livable room downstairs, or if you were to do some rejigging upstairs and make that single big enough to become a double, when you're looking at 4 to 5 rooms, it really depends where you are in the city.
What would you rent a room as a ballpark figure? And just take the average across the city as a...
So the big difference is whether or not there's an ensuite. An ensuite makes a massive difference in price, and it tends to find that a lot of investors go down the all ensuite route in order to achieve those bigger prices, which comes with its own set of challenges that we can touch on later. But in terms of an average, if you include bills and council tax to the tenant, you'd be looking at least 550. For some ensuites in some areas, you can be looking at 750, 800.
Right. So if you take the 3 bedrooms and turn it into 4, and you've got ensuites and you're up to, we'll say 750. Mm-hmm. So 4 of those is obviously a lot more than the 1400.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely. Yeah. So, you know, you've got the £3,000 rent income there. If you've got 4 at 750, you'd have to have a pretty nice house to get 4 750 ensuite rooms out of it, but it's not unheard of and not impossible. Of course, alongside that, you've got extra operational expenses. So whenever you're providing an HMO room, as a landlord, you're liable for council tax, so you have to pay the council tax. You also, 99 times out of 100, are going to provide bills, so you're going to have to pay for the electricity, the water, the gas, the broadband, the TV license, mm-hmm. and everything that goes along with it there. But if you work that out to be approximately £100 to £120 a room, you're still looking at a much higher cash flow model than you would if you just went down the standard family route, which is why a lot of investors are turning to HMOs.
And what would a 1-bed flat in a newish apartment cost in the city?
It depends where you are and whether or not you...
Monthly rent.
Oh, monthly rent, sorry. So probably about 800 or so, to 850, 900. Again, if you come closer to the city centre, those prices start to skyrocket, but kind of looking at average across the city.
Okay, so you can see straight away as a tenant, like you, and presumably if you're the sole tenant in a you've taken a tenancy on a one bed apartment, you've got to cover all the bills on top, which, and just take those to be the same 120. It could be a bit more, obviously, but you've got a differential, and it becomes appealing if you've got your own ensuite. You might be out of the house a lot of the time, and so you've got a few more pounds in your pocket. You get to have a little bit of interaction with other people. You might consider an HMO for those reasons.
Absolutely. And you have to look at why people want to live in shared houses. And one you've highlighted there is definitely the cost saving. You know, if you're taking on those liabilities of all the bills and council tax yourself, that can be quite expensive on top of a one bed flat. But COVID aside, because that's thrown a spanner in the works, we often see that people that are new to the city, they want to live in a shared house because they want to get to know other people in that area. Sometimes we see people who are moving to a new job and there may be two people are moving. They met each other as part of the training for that job on, say, a graduate scheme. They found a house together, so two people will take two rooms inside a shared property. Or often they'll be moving from somewhere else in the country and they want that communal space to get to know people. And it's not uncommon for maybe two or three tenants to say, actually, we're going to go and find a house just the two or three of us because we've got on so well inside this shared house that we then want to move on and find a property just for ourselves. So, you know, what do people want from an HMO? They obviously want something that is more cost effective, but they also want an experience and an opportunity to get to know other people within the city. So, where does that factor in for us as investors? Well, we have to look at that property and think about it with the tenant's perspective in mind and say, okay, well, we need to make sure that the living space is not only adequate, but provides that opportunity to get to know each other. So, for example, in all of our HMOs, we provide a Netflix account on the smart TV because everybody bonds over film and TV, and there's always a sofa that they can kick back and watch their favorite programs or movies with each other, so they can start to build up that level of community. From an investment perspective, a Netflix account is not a big monthly expense, but from a value perspective to the tenants, that offers immense value and gives them the chance to get to know each other and build up, like I said, that sense of community, which is extremely powerful.
And as a active member, or indeed an up and coming leader within the Bristol property community, you run the Bristol Property Meet and the Partners in Property Bristol network, but both which are well respected, well known ways that people who are either in property in Bristol or are looking at getting involved in property in Bristol, either as a investor or as a service provider in some shape or form in and around property. That they come together. There's a sense of community. What's the feeling about HMOs within those communities? Now, is
One
it a
thing I
good
can
thing?
say.
Is it a bad thing? Does it depend on whether you've got one? Like, what's the chat out there?
From people that don't know and understand the models, it's generally fear because they hear a lot of horror stories around HMOs. And I've seen pictures of properties that have been absolutely decimated. I mean, one in particular where the boiler was actually stolen from the house so it could be sold, because people aren't doing it properly. I mean, if I were to take you back to when we first started, and the reason that we started is because as a student in Bristol, I stayed in some pretty atrocious HMOs, and the ones that we viewed and didn't take were even worse. You wouldn't want your dog living in some of these houses. And we realized that there was just a massive gap in the market for someone that wanted to do this properly, wanted to provide a quality product, but also provide a quality service. Because well, we just weren't looked after. We weren't looked after by the landlord. We weren't looked after by the letting agent. And it was just a realization that things could be done so, so much better. So some of the things that we've done along the way, if I kind of bring you back to the modern day and what's made a difference in that space, and we're seeing more and more investors doing this, which is fantastic, is using local artists. So if we look at the cost of wallpapering a wall, for example, you might wallpaper a wall for £150 plus paper. I can get a local artist in who can do a bespoke mural on that wall for exactly the same cost. But the value that has and the uniqueness it gives that property is immeasurable. You know, the impact is huge. It's so, so valuable. And people then moving into that property, they feel a pride in where they are, which means they're going to look after it. And one of the biggest challenges around HMOs can be the footfall and the additional wear and tear on a property. So, you know, there are little things that you can do that make a massive difference. In terms of how people see it when they're coming to property networking events, I think it depends how much they know about it and who they know that's doing it. If they've only met student landlords who have their properties trashed every year, then to them it's an anathema. Why would you want your property trashed every single year? Whereas actually, if they've met some of the people like we have in Bristol that are really, really doing a good job and providing some serious quality, then they're more open and receptive to it. One of the biggest problems can be with HMOs, and we see this all the time, is people come straight off the back of a training course where what they're told is HMO is a high cash flow model, which, to be fair, it definitely is, but they just think it's easy and they're not told the pitfalls and things that can go wrong. So you have to make sure that you know what you're getting yourself in for if you do want to invest in HMOs. But by taking the time to educate yourself and doing it properly, you can build a very, very, great portfolio of properties and investments that will stand the test of time if you are able to, you know, make intelligent decisions from the offset.
We've had a number of other really interesting HMO investors and people who have built HMO portfolios on. There's a really good one by a HMO landlord who has had 5 years with not one day of voids, which is really incredible. It's a reflection of the quality of the refurb and the systemization of turnaround. Mm-hmm. Now that's not a typical example, and there's another really good episode with Adam Lawrence from Partners in Property, and he doesn't fully answer the question, but we talk about it at great length as to is it time to think about converting some of these HMOs back into either flats or single use properties. Now, what in your mind are the key challenges in HMOs at the moment in Bristol, and what's the game plan for either dealing with these or not?
So the key challenges in HMOs, if we kind of take a zoomed out look for a second, is, like I said, the market is becoming flooded with everybody that is rushing to do HMOs. They want to follow the latest trend. They want to create something boutique. They want to follow the latest color schemes. But what that often means is they want to spend a lot of money. They want to spend a lot of money on creating a property that actually doesn't return their investment as they thought it would do, because they've overspent on the refurb. And you have to be realistic. An HMO is a high wear and tear property. There is heavy footfall, especially in some of the communal areas. And when you're putting little frilly decorations and bits and pieces in, you have to appreciate that they may not last in the same way they would in another type of investment. So that's a challenge that's kind of affecting the market as a whole. If we zoom back into Bristol and have a look at one of the biggest challenges in Bristol, is the increased regulation, especially for things like Article 4. So Bristol is broken into two council boundaries, which is the Bristol City Council and the South Gloucester Council. And Bristol Council have brought in an Article 4 directive in pretty much everywhere you would want an HMO. So what is an Article 4 directive? Well, at the moment, under the National Planning Framework, you can convert from a residential family home, your normal home, like we were talking about earlier, three bed semi, which is residential class C3. To a small HMO from 3 to 6 people from 2 or more households, which is residential class C4. So without Article 4 in place, you can do that under permitted development, no problems. You can convert into an HMO and rent out the property without having to request permission from the planning department. What Article 4 does is it removes that permitted development right. And the reason councils bring that in is because they want to try and control the volume of HMOs in any given area. Now, when it comes to an Article 4 area, a lot of people say, don't touch it with a barge pole. It can't be done. You can't create more HMOs there. And on the most part, that is true. However, usually the rules are with Article 4 that you can't sandwich a property. So there's two things. First of all, you can't sandwich a property, which means if you want to make an HMO, so you put a planning application in to go from C3 to C4, and you either side of you is an HMO, you can't do it. It's just not going to happen because you're trying to sandwich. You can't have three HMOs in a row. The other thing they look for is saturation. So they want to know whether within 100 meter radius, there is any more than 10% of those properties that are already HMOs. So if you pick your property, put a dot on the map, draw a 100 meter circle around it, reference that back to the council's license, then you'll be able to know whether or not you're in a saturated area and whether or not you'll be able to get an HMO. So Article 4 doesn't make creating new HMOs impossible, but it does make it that little bit more challenging.
It's really interesting, and I can see how planning theorists and people who come up with the policies, they just can't win, really. They're never going to make everyone happy. So in terms of your approach as an agency, you touched on your earlier experiences and where you were living in a shared property as a university student. And then going in and setting up the family property business, which has a great outsourcing and a technology solution for the property management, which you're using in your own portfolio and as part of the agency's operation. What are you guys trying to do that's different, and why?
I think that comes back to the concept of disrupting the space and wanting, like I said, to do things differently, is to provide a quality product, but also to provide a quality service. So when we evaluated the experience that I had, we had to look at, well, who was at fault there? The fault was lie with the landlord because the property was not up to standard. But the fault also was with the estate agent or the letting agent because they weren't looking after that property and they weren't managing our tenancy properly. So from a landlord's perspective, how can we solve that problem? Well, the first thing we can do is use things like local artists to create a space that people actually want to live in. We can do colours in rooms. We can not just whitewash a property and then expect someone just to want to move in there. When we first started, I remember one investor in particular thought we were crazy for wanting to provide curtains. It was like, well, hang on a minute. Would you want to live in a property without curtains? You know, with no blinds or curtains on a window? Of course not. Well, his logic was, well, they're just going to pull them down anyway. It's like, well, if that's your mentality and how you think about who your housemates are going to be, well, then no wonder they're not staying in your property and no wonder they're not going to look after it. So having that customer first approach, and tenants are your customers at the end of the day, makes a huge, huge difference. And you have to, as a landlord, again, create that environment that people want to be in. So the Netflix accounts, we have a Hall of Fame up on the wall, and every tenant when they move in has a photo up on the wall and it goes up there on the Hall of Fame. And if their room's got a colour, then their name will be written in the colour. So everybody knows who's in that property. And again, you're trying to create a community. One of the things that we spoke to people about when we first started was, what have been your experiences in shared houses, both good and bad? And often one of the bad can be that they don't necessarily know all of their housemates, because as you spoke about earlier, people are working long hours, sometimes shift work. They may not see each other for days, even weeks at end. And tenancy changeovers are more frequent in a shared house than they are in your standard, you know, family rental property. So they would see people on the stairs and think, are you supposed to be here? Have you let yourself into this house? Are you a resident? What's going on? So that was the reason behind, as well as to create the community, putting our Hall of Fame up on the photos. So that's kind of from the landlord side, is creating that product that people want to be a part of. And, you know, if you're looking at Bristol, there are a couple of investors in Bristol, people like Higgy House, people like Habibo, that create some beautiful spaces. They do a fantastic job. And I think the proof is in the pudding. I saw a post on Facebook recently where someone was asking the question, and it was about a planning application going in for a sui generis HMO. So a sui generis HMO is a large HMO, 7 or more people, and they've got a bit of a stigma attached to them because they're not often done to the highest of standards. And this question was asking, you know, well, let's be honest, who would really want to, you know, live next to an HMO? And I thought and thought about it. I thought, well, actually, to be honest with you, I live in some of our HMOs, not just next door to them, because the people are fantastic. The properties are fantastic. And, you know, they have a proper community there. They actually get on with each other and they're friends. And we have people that have been in our HMOs for 4+ years, which just doesn't happen very often. And that says to me that we're doing something right and that they're happy living there if they wanted to stay for, you know, 4 years. I think that makes a big, big difference. So, you know, from a landlord's perspective, you need to create that quality product. From an agent's perspective, it's all about setting up the houses properly and setting up expectations and then delivering on that service. So setting up houses properly, you need to think about who is in that property. What tenant type are you working to? Not just student or professional, but for example, are people on shift work? Do you want to put someone that's on shift work with someone who in their tenant bio has said, actually, I quite like to go out and meet people and go and do social events? Well, they're just going to be fractious. They're not going to get along with each other because they want different things from the property they want to live in. Neither is right, neither is wrong, but you shouldn't put the two together. So as an HMO management agency or as an HMO self-managing landlord, you need to think about the different tenants that you have in your property to make sure that you're putting like with like. And one of the things we often do is we ask before anybody moves in with us, what are your hobbies and interests? And more importantly, what would you like from a shared house? Because you know that if you've got that data on file from people that are already living there, you can pair people up and you can match like with like and create harmonious households as opposed to households that will just argue with each other. So then once you've created the house, it's then about managing it and keeping on top of things. So for example, all of our maintenance is done via WhatsApp. And I get such a kind of half and half response from that when I tell HMO landlords that we do everything by WhatsApp. Half of them, they get it. They know what we're trying to achieve. The other half think, my goodness, if I put everyone in that house on a WhatsApp group, it would never stop pinging. I'd be in a world of trouble. And actually, it would just drive me around the bend. Well, if that's the case, then you're doing something wrong. You know, you haven't created that harmonious household and you aren't able to, you know, bring people together that are going to get along. So the reason we use WhatsApp is because it's open, transparent communication between us and the housemates at all times. From a selfish perspective, it also means I've not got to take 5 emails if there's a leaky tap in a bathroom because there's going to be 5 people that want to report that problem. Everybody knows what's going on. So it's about creating that service. So you've got to look at it from both sides as the landlord, but also as the managing agent.
So in terms of communication with the council, that's a huge part of running what effectively is it can't be anything other than a property business. A lot of landlords who may have a single buy-to-let and there's been a family there for 10 years and they just pay the rent every month and there's no problems. Maybe they get the EPCs and the electrical certifications and things. But there's a whole other compliance burden which revolves around safety and effectively living standards that the council are quite big on. What is your philosophy in terms of approaching this and how does it work in practical terms?
I think you've hit the nail on the head there by calling it a property business. And you're absolutely right. There are some landlords who have got the attitude of, well, that's how I've always done it. It's like, maybe that is how you've always done it, but that's not how you can do it now. And things have to change moving forwards. It's no surprise to anybody that the government is trying to professionalize the property sector. We've seen it with many, many reforms that are coming in. And there's actually 178 pieces of legislation that link back to being a landlord. And when it comes to shared houses and HMOs, it's even more complicated. You need to know the rules inside out. So you need to know what your council wants. Every council is different. There's a minimum national standards, but the council, if they want to, can increase those standards for their particular area.
So those standards relate to space and fire safety and...
Yeah, so those standards relate to absolutely everything within the property. So you need to go onto the council website, you need to find the standards for your area and you need to learn them inside out. You need to know, for example, that your standard room for one person is a minimum of 6.51 square meters or 10.22 if you've got a couple. So you need to know these things. Then once you've looked at the council standards, you need to understand the fire safety. You need to understand fire safety for every single type of property. But if you imagine an HMO is a high risk property because you've got more people who will be cooking meals normally independently and therefore using the facilities that are more likely to cause a fire. So you need to know about different types of fire system. What does grade A mean? What does grade D mean? So grade A is a system that has a board downstairs. It needs to be tested once a week. Grade D is a system that doesn't have a board, but it's mains powered, battery backup, and then the coverage in the property is as it needs to be. That needs to be tested once a month. You need to know how often you need an electrician to come in and change them. So there is lots and lots of different regulation items, and how that manifests itself practically is knowing and learning the rules. Of course, with every property, you've got HHSRS, which is your health and safety rating system, looking at risks, looking at compounding risks. So, for example, if you've got particularly steep stairs alone, that may not be a risk. But if you've got particularly steep stairs that then you've got post on the floor when you've done an inspection, that risk is only going to get more. If you've then got a cupboard at the bottom, someone might fall down the stairs, slip on the post and bang the head on the cupboard. That now becomes a greater risk. So it's about understanding and walking around the property. The analogy we always use is walk around the property as if you'd had a few too many drinks. How may you hurt yourself? And when you see that and you think, actually, I could hurt myself on this or I could hurt myself on that, then that's likely to be a hazard. So it's not something you can go into with your eyes closed. It's not for the faint-hearted. If you get the property management side wrong, you will create a world of pain for yourself. And if you get the compliance side wrong, it can be even more of a problem. And you mentioned about working with the council. The council at the moment are on an absolute warpath. They really want landlords, especially shared house landlords. South Gloss and Bristol, which are the two councils that we work in, South Gloss fined someone about £8,000 2-3 weeks ago, and Bristol got someone to the tune of £48,000 2 months ago because they didn't have a licence in place. So you have to do things properly. There's no cutting corners and there's no grey area when it comes to compliance. What the council says goes. You know, with every HMO licence, they will come and inspect. As part of that inspection, things will almost certainly that you may not have known about will be wrong. So you have to make sure you get them done and you have to keep on top of standards. The council will also do regular updates, and if you keep in touch with them, you can stay on the front foot and be proactive. So for example, Bristol have just changed their rules recently to say that you must have a fire door on every kitchen. That never was the case before, but now everyone's getting fire doors put in place. You've always needed the alarms, but now the fire doors and closers and smoke seals need to be there too. So that's something that people are going out and looking for. And as part of an asset management plan, you have to budget for these things. You have to know that compliance is going to change, that it's going to get more regulated. They're never going to turn around and say, actually, you know what, you don't need that fire door anymore, because they're not going to take safety away from tenants. They're only going to make it more and more and more. So you have to allocate that as part of your budget. When you come back to the example we looked at before and you've got a gross rent roll of 3,000 from a house that maybe made you 1,400 before, there is that margin to be able to do that. And you just have to make sure that you factor that in and not forget about that as you go along.
Yeah, that's a really interesting point. We're in the middle of a purchase at the moment where the current landlords are in court proceedings where they hadn't kept up the fire safety standards. And it's pretty simple stuff. Like you're talking about making sure that fire doors, that there's not a gap in between, that you've got the seals, that you've done the checks, that you've documented that you're being responsible. When you're offering a product or a service, someone's kid is going to be in Bristol, a fair portion of the population who are in shared properties, I'd say most of them would be under 35. So they're someone's kid. If they put their head down at night, you want to know that the place isn't going to burn down around them. And if it does catch on fire, that they're safely going to be able to get out of it, and that there's sufficient time to do so, the alarms are in place. And I think it's really important. I hear people talking about the councils being too hard on these things. I personally think they should, if anything, be at a higher level, and that our role as a as a asset manager or anyone who's involved in that industry should be to make it easy for the council officers to do their compliance checks with you. We make a conscious effort of communicating in detail, in full. When something's requested, we supply it in full, and that we provide things in advance. And by doing so, and not looking to get into an argument about is this fair or is this not fair, or we assume it's the right thing, and we look to do it right. And we're in a different space, obviously, social housing. And you're doing a great job at the moment, Ben. So well done. I'd love to get you back on. I keep meaning to have an episode with you about the outsourcing and the software that you've built up around that. So with your permission, we'll get you back on. But once again, your letting agency website for Bristol is?
It's KPA, so kpa.co.uk. And I would love to come back on and have a discussion with you about the systems and tech and everything we've brought in from that side.
Right. And of course, if someone would like to meet up with Ben, I'd encourage you to join either the Bristol Property Meet, which is an online, network of people getting together, either newbies or people who have been in the game for a bit longer, and pairing them up and inserting a little bit of enthusiasm with a little bit of seasoned experience. And Partners in Property, which is in person once a month, daytime event. And I think you get a bit of lunch, I understand.
Yeah, you absolutely do. So our Partners in Property event is up at the Engineer's House in Clifton. It's a beautiful building in itself, so it starts the day off well, and they put on a very good spread there. I know you're a PIP London member, Will, so you'll have to come across to Bristol and come and join us.
I think it's a must sometime over the next couple of months. Well, Ben Nichols, once again, it's been a pleasure having you on My Property World podcast. I'm Will Mallard. Ben Nichols, thank you.
Thank you very much, Will. Pleasure's all mine.
Welcome to My Property World, a light and informative look at all things property. We have designed this series for people involved in property and property finance in the UK market. However, we do take examples from all around the property world. Our aim is for us to make money from property together, whether that be buying, selling, financing, trading, or getting involved in a deal in another way. We do this by informing, entertaining, and enjoying ourselves talking property, which gives you a chance to get to know us, what we're up to, and to check us out until you're ready to make money together. In the meantime, My Property World is free and fun, so plug in your headphones and enjoy. We would love for you to like, share, and comment, so please do on social media. And if you have questions, ideas for topics, or deals you would like to explore, we're always looking for guests, so get in touch via the My Property World profile.